This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Capital punishment is practiced in 37 states. New York Governor George Pataki has vowed to make his state the 38th. In Pennsylvania, where the death penalty is legal but no one has been executed since 1962, the new governor, Tom Ridge, says he intends to make sure that the death penalty exists in more than name only. And the Republican crime bill now being debated promises to make the death penalty easier to impose. My guest David Vondrelli has written a new book about capital punishment from several perspectives. It's called Among the Lowest of the Dead, The Culture of Death Row. He focuses on Florida's death row and tells the stories of men who have been executed, their defenders and prosecutors, and the families of victims. Vondrelli is the arts editor of The Washington Post, where he previously covered national politics. In 1979, John Spenkelink became the first person to be executed against his will in 12 years. Vondrelli says the most important thing he learned from that famous Florida case is how much money, brains, and energy the death penalty could consume.
John Spenkelink was a perfect case for that because the facts of his case were not very distinguished at all. He killed another criminal in a dispute over money. He was offered a chance to plead guilty to second-degree murder, and he would have been up for parole about the time he was executed. He foolishly didn't take the deal. But his case, that simple case, took almost 6 years to get through the appeals process. The entire state of Florida was focused on it. In the last hours, you had state attorneys flying all over the country on the governor's private jet, fighting the appeals in New Orleans and in Washington, D.C., and back in Tallahassee. You had this tremendous defense team. His lead lawyer, in fact, is now the lawyer for President Clinton on the Whitewater matters, a guy named David Kendall. So top-flight legal power on both sides, fortunes being spent. What people didn't quite realize, I think, at the time was that that wasn't going to be an exception. That was going to become the rule, and you'd have these kinds of last-minute dramatic fights being fought in every one of these thousands of cases. It's filling up the courts in Florida. The state Supreme Court spends half its time on death cases, and the federal courts about half their time. It's tremendously time-consuming and money-consuming, and that turned out to be the real lesson.
Why does the death penalty consume so much time and money?
Because the courts have said that the death penalty has to be perfect. It has to make sense from case to case. It has to stand up. Who gets it has to make sense. And so that's very hard to do with cases that are not the same. They're different. Every one of these tragedies, these awful murders, is different in its own way. To try and find out what's the same and what's different in these cases takes tremendous attention from judges. And the judges and lawyers want to get it right. They don't want to be executing people willy-nilly. And the defense attorneys really believe that either there shouldn't be a death penalty or it should be held to its promises, and so they fight. These kinds of hard-fought lawsuits, as we all know, can consume years and millions of dollars, and they do.
The Republican crime bill would limit the period of time that an inmate can file a habeas corpus petition to challenge the constitutionality of their death sentence. Would that make it cheaper?
If that happened, I imagine it could. The thing that people aren't telling the American public is that the federal courts have been clamping down on habeas corpus at least since 1983. For at least a dozen years, it's been very, very, very hard for a death row inmate to lodge a second or a third habeas corpus appeal. They get one bite at the apple, pretty much, one full hearing of their habeas corpus. But when there are hundreds of cases per state in the South, and there are 400 people on death row in California, over 200 in Pennsylvania and Illinois, it takes a long time. There are log jams in the courts. And so it's not that the inmates are hanging around delaying their appeals. The fact is, the inmates are likely to win. half of all the death sentences in America are overturned on appeal. And so the inmates, they're in the driver's seat in terms of their chances. They'd just as soon see these things adjudicated. So the promise there that's being made by the Republican crime bill is, I think it's a pig in the poke, because these experiments with limiting habeas corpus have been going on, as I say, for over a decade without success.
You write that there was another big story that was the outcome of the Spankulink execution, and that is that death rows, instead of shrinking when executions began again, they grew.
That's right. There were 134 people on death row the day Spankulink was executed. Today in Florida, there are 349 people on death row. It's not really a death row anymore the way you think of death row, with a few grizzled guys all sitting around smoking cigarettes and trying to cheer each other up. It's more like a death town. I once counted up in the Florida Gazetteer to find out how many incorporated cities, villages, towns there were in the state of Florida that were smaller than the population of death row. It was 450.
Has the death row grown because more people are sentenced to death, or because of how slowly the people who are sentenced to death are executed?
It's both. We're sentencing a tremendous number of people to death in America, about 300 a year across the country. So it's that combination of a lot of death sentences out there, and then this very slow, deliberative, and ultimately stymied system for getting the people who are sentenced actually executed.
David Vondrelli is my guest, and he's written a new book called Among the Lowest of the Dead, The Culture of Death Row. Did you spend much time on death row when you were researching your book?
I spent a lot of time with death row inmates. Most of what I know about life on death row comes from interviewing inmates at great length, hour after hour, just asking them how they spend their time, how a typical day goes. They spend about 23 hours a day in their cells, which are the size of bathrooms. They watch TV. They play Jeopardy competitively every night. They all watch the news on the same station so that they can argue about it afterwards. Just the years drone on and on and on.
I guess TV is about the only thing that changes.
TV is...
If you want something new to talk about.
That's right. And they don't have the cable, so it's just the broadcast stations. Interestingly to me was the reaction of the prison officials to the television, because you frequently hear politicians and ordinary citizens who get really angry about the idea that these horrible people on death row, they've committed these terrible crimes, they have TVs in their cells. And so I ask a number of wardens and guards, what do you think of these TVs? And they call them electronic pacifiers, and they wouldn't live without them. One warden told me that an angry state senator had once come to him and said, you got to get the TVs out of their cells. This is terrible. We're coddling the criminals. And the warden looked at him and said, that's fine. You go in there and take them out.
So some of the wardens saw television as a way of keeping control.
It keeps control. It gives them something to do. They dread the day that they'd have to deal with those people if they had nothing to do.
Did you watch any executions?
I did watch an execution in 1991 of a murderer named Roy Allen Herridge, who was electrocuted in Old Sparky, as they call the electric chair in Florida. It was an intense experience for me. I didn't really know what to expect, although I'd talked to many people who'd witnessed. You really don't know until you do it. The procedure itself is like... it's unreal. It's like a magic trick. They strap the guy into the chair and they cover his face, and then they throw the switch, and there's a little cloud of steam as the water boils off the sponges at the electrodes. And it's also sort of mysterious and almost mystical. It seems like a stunt, a magic trick. But it was in the moments before the actual execution when Herridge was being strapped in, And he was looking at the witnesses through this glass that separated us from him. And his head was going back and forth. He was scanning us sort of like a surveillance camera in a drugstore. And I found myself praying that he wouldn't pause and look right at me. Even though I knew the terrible things he'd done, I found myself really ashamed to be there watching this most intimate, humiliating, shameful moment for him. The worst thing that can be said about a man is that he's so bad he has to be killed. And there I was looking at it, and I didn't want him to know. I didn't want him to look at me and wonder who I was and why I was there.
Is he one of the people who you knew because you'd interviewed him?
I had never interviewed him. My name came up in a sort of lottery to see one, and that happened to be the one. I'd never met him.
My guest is journalist David Vondrelli. He's the author of the new book, Among the Lowest of the Dead, The Culture of Death Row. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about capital punishment with David Vondrelli, author of Among the Lowest of the Dead. Your book isn't just about the people on death row. It's also about families of victims.
Right.
And one family that you write about, David and Wendy Nelson, were the parents of a 10-year-old girl who was murdered.
Right.
And how does the death penalty look from their point of view as survivors?
Dave and Wendy Nelson had the world by the tail. And one morning in 1980, they had that most horrible experience that can happen to parents. Their little girl was riding her bike to school, and she disappeared, and she was found dead. That was 1980. They became energized by this tragedy to defend and support the death penalty, to push for it, and also to improve just the general way that the Florida courts treat victims. Wendy in particular, has been heroic in fighting for improvements in victims' rights in Florida, and the Florida courts are better for it. She is a strong, brave woman. But no matter how hard she fought, and she got the ear of governors and senators, it didn't make one iota of difference in speeding up the process of executing her daughter's killer, a guy named Larry Mann. The years have gone by. The courts have looked at that case. It's been bounced back down to the trial level twice. It's been through the Florida Supreme Court, which has had difficulty making up its mind. The federal courts have grappled with it. They're going to celebrate what would have been Elisa Nelson's 25th birthday soon, and Larry Mann is still alive. And that story was very powerful to me. I don't want to make it sound like Wendy or Dave has given up on the death penalty. They're still strong supporters. But to see what they've gone through waiting for something that has never been delivered and may never be delivered was, to me, an indictment of the process.
Why do they feel strongly that Larry Mann, their daughter's killer, should be executed as opposed to spending life in prison?
Wendy told me that she was raised in a family that believed in the death penalty as a sort of primal justice. Take a life, you pay with your own life. And she also told me that in her work with victims, she's seen families that have had to go to parole hearings year after year, have had to live with the fear that the killer of their loved ones would be released someday, and that what she really wanted was that at some point there'd be an end to it all, and that Larry Mann would be out of her life completely. Some victims who have seen the killer executed have had that relief. One of the problems for me with the death penalty in America today is it promises an execution in hundreds and hundreds of cases, but so far only about 2 or 3% of those death sentences have been carried out in America. And so you have, for every 100 victims' families that are promised this relief, this closure, only two or three ever get it, and the other 97 are disappointed.
Well, that fact is used by both sides of the debate. One side said, so let's make it easier to execute them. And the other side says, so what's the point of this game?
And what I'm trying to say is that I've been to Florida. I've talked to everyone involved. I've looked at what they've been doing for the past 25 years. I've said, I've come to the conclusion, as most of the people who know the death penalty best have, that it's not going to get any faster. It's not fixable because this level of perfection can't be achieved.
The level of perfection in deciding who should get it and who should not.
It's become an endless weighing and reweighing, the courts arguing back and forth among themselves and even with themselves. There's a character in the book, Doug McRae, who was on death row for 17 years. His case never got past the first level of appeals in those 17 years. The state Supreme Court, the first level of appeal, would bounce the case back to the trial court. The trial court would try and fix the problem. It would go back to the Supreme Court. They'd find another problem. It would bounce back again. Ultimately, the state Supreme Court changed its mind in that case about whether Doug McRae should live or die 7 times before his sentence was finally reduced to life in prison. 17 years, 7 changes of mind, that's all in one court. So this perfection is a long way off.
In the years that you spent writing your book about the death penalty and death row, did you feel that you went through any fundamental or surprising shifts of attitude?
On the death penalty itself, I've felt both ways through my life. I've seen crimes that seem to cry out for it, and I've been concerned about the capriciousness of it and the waste of resources involved in it. The researching and the writing of the book changed me most by really bringing home the tragedy of the whole thing, the whole violent American culture. The number of ways there are for lives to go wrong, for people to end up in that worst place on earth, death row. The number of horrible crimes that are committed, the depravities that we're capable of, and the cost that we're paying for breakdowns in social fabric. It made me much more of a social conservative than I was before, in the sense that it drove home for me the importance of family, of self-sacrifice, of community, of ties to one another. That was the real change.
Crime is being debated now in American politics. The Republican crime bill is before Congress. President Clinton signed a crime bill last year.
Mm-hmm.
What's your critique of how crime and punishment is being debated in America now?
One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I got so tired of listening to politicians in both parties give as their answer to crime the death penalty, that there'd be more death penalties and we'd get tougher on crime by having more death penalties. And I knew from my research that toughness on crime had nothing to do with the death penalty, that as I say and as others have said, that the death penalty in modern America is a mockery of justice. So a big part of it was to try. I hope that if someone goes through this book, they'll have a feeling for what the reality is, like it or hate it, and they'll be able to go back to the public debate and demand more of their political leaders, real solutions, real responses. The book doesn't begin to enumerate what those are, but they're personal, they're social, and they're technical. Here in New York City, where I am this week, the crime rate has been falling for the past 3 years. The murder rate has been dropping. All the violent crime levels have been dropping. why is that? We need to be examining what works. New York instead is about to turn to a death penalty. And 15 years from now, I'm positive they're going to be as frustrated as the people of Florida, as the people of California, the people of Illinois, the people of Pennsylvania are right now.
When you were doing your research into death row and when you were interviewing men who were on death row, were you conscious of not wanting to be a soft touch?
Yes. I kept reminding myself that these are really bad people. And I wouldn't just stay in Stark, which is the most aptly named town in America. It's the site of the Florida State Prison. I wouldn't stay in Stark and do interview after interview after interview at the prison because I didn't want to be wrapped up in that view of the world. I would go, I would do a couple of interviews there, and then I'd leave and go talk to victims. Or I'd leave and go talk to prosecutors or people in a governor's office. Or I'd go back to the newspaper clipping files and read through the account of the crime that man I'd been talking to on death row had committed. And that was always a reality check for me. Because you're sitting in a room with someone who's been on death row a long time, their muscle tone is gone, most of them have been pretty well broken by that experience, they've aged, they've mellowed out, most of them. And you can begin to find yourself really sympathizing with them, and that's a dangerous thing to do because the sympathy in this country does belong with the victims of crime and shouldn't leave that place.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Vondreli is the author of Among the Lowest of the Dead, The Culture of Death Row. He's the arts editor of The Washington Post. I'm Cherie Gross, and this is Fresh Air.